Hi, welcome back to Military Law and Life Matters, the podcast that arms you with knowledge so you don't become a victim of injustice. So I'm Farah Osbeck back again. This is the first podcast of the series where I'm going to be interviewing attorneys who focus primarily on the military community. And many of these attorneys, as I discussed, are former military JAGs, reservists perhaps, perhaps not, perhaps just veterans, or they might be retired. So really happy to present the first interview, and that's going to be with attorney Patrick Hughes. Now, Patrick is the co-founder of Patriots Law Group. It's a law firm he started with his friend and former active duty Air Force JAG colleague, Michael Lyons. Pat served nearly 7 years on active duty and then transferred to the reserve as he formed the Patriots Law Group in 2017. And like every JAG, he started out his Air Force career as a prosecutor, and then his next assignment was a defense counsel. And as a defense counsel, he was ranked the number one of 84 area defense counsel globally. Very, very impressive. In his final assignment on active duty, he shifted his focus to civil litigation, and he defended the Air Force in federal courts pertaining to matters that involved, among other things, military pay disputes. And there he represented the Air Force in lawsuits brought by military service members involving claims that the military had unlawfully denied them entitlements. And in many cases, these claims were six or seven figure money demands. And also class action lawsuits brought by service members. Oftentimes, these cases would be brought by a service member who first sought relief at the Board for Correction of Military Records, and the claims were denied there, so then the members would sue in federal court. Pat also defended the Air Force against federal civilian employees who brought discrimination claims before the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, and when challenging their adverse personnel actions before the Merit Systems Protection Board. So he had a lot of extensive experience defending the Air Force. And now in his private practice, Pat represents service members. He represents members primarily in the civilian realm, including administrative claims brought in the boards for correction of military records for each service, and claims for military pay brought either in the Court of Federal Claims or claims taken up in the Federal District Court. So he's going to discuss that during our interview. So today I'm going to talk to Patrick about his practice. He's going to talk to us about the various claims on behalf of service members when they are denied entitlements and how he helps them. So I'm very happy to introduce you shortly to Patrick Hughes. Good morning, Patrick. So happy to have you join our podcast. How are you doing?
Fair. I'm doing really well. Thanks very much for having me. I listened to your last podcast, and just to give you some words of encouragement as you were talking, I really, really appreciate all that you're doing for the military community with these podcasts. I think that it's wonderful. It's definitely very helpful, I even for myself.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. Yeah, I really enjoy doing it. I love to have these different series, and I wanted to, actually share knowledge with the military community. And you're the first one that I'm interviewing, so I'm so excited. So I already, Patrick, introduced your background, talked about your impressive career in the Air Force as an Air Force JAG, and what you do as a civilian attorney. So we can get into the main topic of our interview today, which is basically how you sue the government on behalf of military members, Patrick. So, so I'm excited to, learn about that and share that with the members listening. So, Patrick, I know that basically a lot of service members don't know you could sue the military, because when they're a military member, they're like, well, I can't sue the government. Why is that? Is there that perception out there?
Yeah, so it's a sticky thing, because I am still in the reserve, and sometimes I find myself having to go up against our employer, the Department of Defense. But I became a JAG, I wasn't aware of at the time what the name of this doctrine was, the Ferries Doctrine, that I think you even mentioned in your prior podcast. But it's based on a 1950 Supreme Court case, and it's all about basically the inability to sue the government for medical malpractice or other claims that sound in tort, the area of law called a tort. And the main reason behind that is because if you think about it, if, for example, there's some form of medical malpractice that occurs on the battlefield or in a hospital when someone, you know, in the fog of war or something, the last thing that the military or the United States government would want is that people are turning around and suing the United States for that. And so I think that that doctrine, or at least the concept behind it, has kind of trickled into other beliefs of military members, that they just quite simply cannot sue their employer because of potentially the denial of money or other things. I think just in a general sense, they just don't believe or are aware that they can sue their employer in those types of situations. And so that's really where I think it probably stems from. And I don't think that I even really had a good grasp until I started working a particular job with the Air Force in my last assignment, where I started to learn what types of cases could actually be taken against the United States, against the military, the employer of that service member. And so I think that may be the reason behind why.
Yeah, that makes sense. And going back to, you know, military members and you being reservist, the thing is, I do know the military, at least we were in the Air Force, they want, you know, zealous advocates for the clients, which is why they picked the best JAGs to be the defense counsel, right? The military defense counsel. So they may not want to be sued so much, but I do know they want zealous advocates representing clients like you. So that's great. So, and as far as, well, let me first ask you, so what, in terms of suing the government or the military, whatever service, can you tell us, like, how do you do that? What remedies are available for someone, a military member, who wants to sue the government for some issue?
Sure. So there's something called a waiver of sovereign immunity, first off, right? And so that's basically going back all the way to English common law and how you couldn't sue the crown, essentially, right? And common law is what United States law is based on. And so our government, Congress, has carved out certain statutes and ways to go about suing the United States. If there is not a particular waiver of sovereign immunity, then you're not likely able to sue the United States. And for example, just as we were talking about, that Ferries Doctrine, that's still, even though they've recently come out with an administrative means of pursuing malpractice claims for service members, they've not created a judicial remedy. They've not given that waiver of sovereign immunity to pursue a lawsuit against the United States, they being Congress. But for anything that sounds in a violation of a contract, or a liquidated damage because there's a money mandating statute, that, for example, then there is a waiver of sovereign immunity that the legislation has developed called the Tucker Act. There's also another waiver of sovereign immunity called the Administrative Procedures Act. And those two are what allow a service member to proceed against the Department of Defense, whatever military department, if the violation of law applies to, for example, a denial of a basic pay or a basic allowance for housing, something that would be a money mandating entitlement, you have the ability to pursue in federal court an action against your employer as a service member. So those would be the judicial remedies. And then, of course, before you even get there, if you so desire, you can proceed to the boards for corrections of each military department. And it's their duty under 10 United States Code Section 1552 to cure any material error or injustice. And that's actually a big distinction, that last word there that should be made, that injustice word. These boards for corrections, they're granted by Congress the power of equity to essentially determine what is fair and not. And if something was unfair, then they can cure that injustice by correcting a military record that would then, you know, end up giving the service member the relief that he or she is asking for. But the distinction between what the boards for corrections can do and what a court can do is fairly large, in that those courts that were taking a Tucker Act or an Administrative Procedures Act claim do not have powers of equity. It's only a matter of law that you can get relief from these courts. And so that's going to play a role in how one might proceed if they feel like they have a cause of action against the military. They might choose at first to proceed the administrative route through a board for corrections and then a follow-on lawsuit. Or depending on the circumstances, I might be advising my client that it would be a better approach to sue first, which is an option pretty often. But it does definitely depend on the factual circumstances of each person's case.
Okay. So Pat, before you go into and explain to us all what, you know, which remedy maybe you would advise the client to take, can you tell us, I know there's no typical case really, but there's probably common types of cases. So militaries know, like, well, what can I sue for? I know you talk about, you know, the contract, et cetera, but yeah. What's kind of a typical reason why you have a client, you know, seeking your, retaining you to help them to sue based on what, or to file a, you know, appeal with the board for correction of military, based on what? What type of action?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, at present, I even have an ongoing proposed class action against the Army for the denial of BAH monies to reservists. That's something that I've done in individual lawsuits. Also, I'm drawing from one that closed out not so long ago for me for a master sergeant in the Air Force. So entitlements, the denial of entitlements is a big one. Something like the denial of a medical retirement as opposed to a regular retirement, or instead of the person not achieving 20 years, they were given a medical severance as opposed to a medical retirement. You need to have a 30% disability rating from the military to be able to medically retire. And anything less than that only avails a severance to the member. And so a dispute over whether that decision was appropriate or not is something that I've been involved in litigating in a court or taking those types of cases up to the boards for corrections. Just recently, I've been retained by a sailor who went on IRR for a couple years, but was supposed to be returned back to being an active reservist, and they failed in doing the paperwork, and she got lost and was not able to return to duty. And they basically said that she could not come back and that she was discharged, which was a clear just clerical error that is now something that we're having to take up with the Board for Corrections of Naval Records. Promotion denials, things like that, where somebody might be pursuing a special selection board. These are all things that are commonly taken to the Boards for Corrections and potentially then pursued in federal court, depending on the outcome that the board's decision is.
Wow. So there's so many different avenues. Yeah. And I know with the cases you talked about regarding the medical retirement, that's a huge issue. And a lot of, and sometimes military services make a mistake if someone maybe did have medical issues that were preventing them from performing their duty, and they just like separate them for maybe misconduct or without the without a retirement. That's huge, because they would actually, if you win that case, right, they would have a regular a medical retirement and get paid every month and be entitled to TRICARE. So I know I used to get a lot of calls about those type of cases, which I didn't handle. I really didn't do medical cases. So mm-hmm. There's no exact typical case, but there's any case if someone feels that somehow they were wronged or something happened, it's good that they talk to an attorney who does this type of stuff, because there's no way they can, I don't think, can to navigate this on their own. So Pat, let me ask you then, how do you then determine or tell a client where should we pursue, through the BCMR first? Because you said sometimes, well, you may go straight to the federal court, either the board for the, I forget the courts you were saying, the claims court or federal district court. How do you determine which one to go to?
Right. Sure. So anything that, and this goes back to what I said a little earlier about how courts only can act in as a matter of law, not equity. And oftentimes, I don't know if it's just a gut instinct on based on the facts that I'm hearing from my clients or potential clients on what approach to take, but you typically need a strong case in the law to be able to go straight to federal court. And there's some real advantages to doing that. One, unfortunately, the Boards for Corrections volume of applications is so large that it's common it can take up to 2 years or even in some cases more than that before you even get a decision on what you're asking them to provide relief on. And believe it or not, civil litigation, the courts, they can move faster than that and often regularly do. But also your attorney's fees, if you pursue a lawsuit, are maybe covered by something called the Equal Access to Justice Act, or EJA. And it may not avail you all of your attorney's fees because there is a calculation on how that is made. And you have to show that you've prevailed and that the government was not substantially justified in its position to get an award of EJA fees. But one thing that you know with certainty is your attorney's fees, if you're going to the Boards for Corrections, are not covered. And so if the law is on your side and it seems like a real good case that could be taken to the courts because of that reason, then it might be better to just go straight to federal court and avoid the overly lengthy delay that a Board for Corrections decision will take, and the possibility that you might even get your attorney's fees if the case looks pretty strong. Now, which court between the Court of Federal Claims or a federal district court depends on the type of issue, obviously. If it's something that is a money claim exceeding $10,000, against the United States, the Court of Federal Claims has exclusive jurisdiction, meaning you can't take the case to any federal district court based on a liquidated damage or a money mandating entitlements like a BAH or something like that. You need to take that case to the Court of Federal Claims. If it's something related to a separate issue, maybe you're just challenging the decision of a Board for Corrections as being arbitrary and capricious, under the Administrative Procedures Act, that case would be taken up in a federal district court. So it really depends on the type of issue that you have as to which waiver of sovereign immunity you're going to rely on, and dependent on that will tell you which court it is that you need to take your case up.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And that's why and with your experience, I'm sure your Air Force experience, where you were actually a defender of the Air Force working in litigation, I'm sure all of that experience helps you immensely when you're doing these cases, helping service members. So is there any other issue, anything else you would consider in determining that, or is that pretty much it?
No, actually, there's a big pitfall. Especially when we're dealing with these Tucker Act cases that get taken up in the Court of Federal Claims. So the Board for Corrections is considered a permissive remedy, meaning you have the ability to pursue it and it exists, but it's not required that you exhaust that remedy through the Board for Corrections in the military and the administrative route before you pursue a lawsuit. And so with respect to a statute of limitations, which is one of the biggest landmines that any attorney needs to be cognizant of when they're discussing a case with their client, under the case law of the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which is where the Court of Federal Claims falls under, the statute of limitations is not told or paused merely because someone decides that they want to go to the Board for Corrections to try to get relief. And so if it takes 2 years to get a decision from the Board for Corrections, and you are already well into when you learned of the harm There's a hard 6-year statute of limitations in this court that if you do not file a lawsuit before the running of that 6 years from when you knew or should have reasonably known when you were financially injured, your lawsuit will be dismissed. The very first move from the Department of Justice will be to file a motion to dismiss of your lawsuit, and they will succeed. If you do not get that lawsuit filed within the 6 years of the date of discovery of the injury, the financial injury. And so if for example, there's kind of a weighing and it might actually make some sense to go to the board for corrections because of the particular issue, but it's only being contemplated less than 2 years from when the statute of limitations would run in federal court, it might actually end up meaning that pursuing the Board for Corrections application would be a bad decision. And the one thing to mention on that also, which helps drive the conversation, is that these Boards for Corrections under their guiding statute, 10 U.S.C. 1552, establishes a 3-year statute of limitation for the Board for Corrections. However, unlike federal courts, this statute of limitations can be waived in the interest of justice, quote, end quote. So if the merits are there, there is some risk to pursue a Board for Corrections application. But if the merits are there, the board can waive that 3-year statute of limitations and still provide you the relief that you're asking for. But it is a risk. If you spend a whole lot of money on an attorney to pursue that application and they just deny it outright because of it being untimely, that's got to be a really frustrating and unfortunate circumstance. So that these factors are considered and weighed with the client, and then the client makes an informed decision on which route to approach. That statute of limitations is a real big issue that can cause someone to run into a major problem that prevents them from getting the relief that they want if they aren't careful.
Okay. And the key for that is when the member knew or should have known about this financial injury or the matter, right? So it's not like, oh, I just thought of this now. For the statute of limitations. So members listening, they can't just like sit on, if they have something, you should definitely look into it and not wait around until you have time to deal with a matter, et cetera. There is something called a statute. Okay.
Right. And I'll just say one thing too, Sarah, is it requires a final agency decision. So really an example of that would be once you are established a debt by DFAS for being overpaid, for example, and you disagree with that decision, you believe that you're entitled to those monies, the moment that you receive that debt, that would be considered a final agency decision that would be the start of the running of that statute of limitations. Okay. And so once that happens, even though you're challenging it through the military, maybe you're challenging it with DFAS, all of that does not pause that 6-year statute of limitations that would require you to file a lawsuit in federal court.
Okay, that makes sense. Good. So, and just for people who may not, I'm sure most of our audience is military, but the BAH is the basic allowance for housing, right? The housing money you were talking about.
Right.
I've seen that, and I've seen, you know, in the press, you're successful. Actions in that. So, Pat, this was very, very helpful. And I think military members, just by listening to this short podcast, are going to understand, like, okay, I can sue the government, you know, based on things that were unjust or things they made a mistake. I mean, the government does make mistakes, of course. And so there's attorneys like you who help. But let's end it with, can you just provide some type of practical, maybe a life lesson, a life matter that would be useful to listeners when they're, you know, navigating this and, intertwined with their legal issues, because legal issues are always intertwined with life matters, but something useful that, you can bring up to military members from your experience that they should know.
Yeah. I ever since I separated from active duty, I started and started my private practice. It was kind of eye-opening to me about how much lawyers cost and how difficult at times it is for people to separate from their emotions when you're suing in a court, for example. The court's only interested in whether a law is violated, and they detach themselves from the emotion of it all, and that's very hard for the client to do. In some of these lawsuits, I mean, they can be very costly. It's a real investment that one needs to make if they're going to have to pay upwards of $20,000 or $30,000 that some of these types of cases can cost in attorney's fees on average, as a median, maybe sometimes more, sometimes less. And so even if you know you're right and that you were mistreated, unfortunately, sometimes pursuing a lawsuit's not the right course. As much as you might end up coming out of it having prevailed, you might have paid more in that pursuit than what it was actually worth that you were denied up front. And so that's one of the things that I'm very cognizant of with my clients, to make them be aware of how a case is going to flow, and to really determine, as much as you might be right here, and as much as the military or whomever you want to sue as a defendant has wronged you, will that remedy that you want to pursue actually be worth doing? And I hate to say it, but there are many times where the answer to that, in my view at least, is no. And so I'll often tell the clients candidly, look, this is not very nice how you were treated, and I completely agree that what happened to you is wrong, but in the end, thinking about it and the likely course that this is going to take, is it actually really worth pursuing, given that it's going to likely cost a large amount in the litigation fees and things like that? Is it worth the pursuit? So that's a lesson that I learned, particularly when I got off of active duty and started my private practice, and just realizing how costly these types of cases can be, and how much lawyers cost, unfortunately. And it's just a matter of the beast, but that's a real consideration that people need to give when they're considering pursuing a lawsuit against the military.
And that's where your wise counsel comes in, where you don't just say, yeah, let's take this case and we're gonna, you know, some lawyers might do that where they're like, oh, just go. And yeah, it doesn't matter. You right. Give counsel so they can make an informed decision. So that's where the ethical part comes in. So Pat, this was just really a great little summary of for members. And I learned a lot too, actually, because I don't practice in this area. That's why I always stay in my lane, and things I do not delve into matters I don't practice in. So appreciate you taking the time to explain to us so clearly, succinctly, about what you can do, that you can sue the military. And there's sometimes, you know, you might feel bad suing it, but there might be reasons. So thank you so much on behalf of all military members and veterans. We forgot to say that, like, these are not all active duty. Sometimes there's a case pending, or that they're now retired or they're separated, right? So it's not just active duty members. Some of them are veterans or retired members. They're still pursuing something from when they were on active duty, right? Just to confirm that.
That's right. As long as you're within that statute of limitations, you're welcome to sue the United States, even if you're now a veteran.
And you could start the suit. You don't have to have started it when you were on active duty. You could start it when you're out of the service, based on, you know, whatever, as long as you meet the statute of limitations. So, okay, Pat, well, it was so good talking to you. Great catching up with you. Thank you again. And we'll end it here, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care, Pat.
Thanks so much, Farah. Take care.
Bye.
So I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with Patrick Hughes. He's a wealth of knowledge. He gave a really great rundown of, you know, why service members sue the service, their service they happen to be in, the government, and what this entails. So it was very he's very knowledgeable, obviously, and it was a really great rundown. So, you know, I really truly believe it's always good to get an expert opinion when you're facing a difficult legal issue. And you should really consult with an attorney who specializes in the matter, not someone who just dabbles in it. You want to go to someone who's an expert, really. Otherwise, you're not going to get the best legal services. And, you know, you're going to get insight into a legal issue and help you make a plan of action to either resolve the issue, or you might decide you do not want to. You know, ignoring a problem just does not make it go away, no matter how difficult it might be. You just really need to confront it head on with smart counsel on your side. And you'll at least get closure, because you might, based on your discussion, decide it's not worth it to pursue it. You don't want to pursue it, or you may not have a case, right? You may not have a legal case. The facts might not be on your side. The law might not be on your side. Or you might decide, yeah, I'm going to pursue it, despite the fact that, yeah, it's going to maybe cost me $20,000-$30,000, as Patrick was discussing, in legal fees, but the possible payoff of what you were perhaps entitled to, it could be, you know, 6-7 figures. So you have to do that analysis, and that's where the attorney, you know, comes in to give you the thoughts. Like, no one could ever guarantee success in a case. I always, you know, talked to clients when I was doing the discharge upgrades and told them what my thoughts were. You never guarantee, but you can give them an idea. Well, yeah, you definitely have a reasonable chance in this case. Oh, no chance in hell in this case, or very, very difficult. But, you know, I believe it's best. You really need to be honest with your clients. So most, you know, ethical lawyers are honest with them and tell them the chances of success. And I mean, I really didn't even take a case unless I thought there was a reasonable chance of success, because I didn't want to waste their time or money. So anyway, yeah, that was a really great rundown. I appreciate Patrick Hughes's time, and I hope you learned something useful that you may need or may not need, but at least you now understand that, yeah, military members and veterans can sue their service or the government. So, as I always say, you know, remember, never, ever give up, because there is always hope. I look forward to talking to you next time. Take care.